long, a civilization will broadcast. Originally, physical scientists chose geological timescales and set L equal to millions of years. This is where the Galactic Club came from. On the other hand, humans started broadcasting with radio waves around 1900, but are now substituting cable and satellite communications for broadcasting. Before long, our signals will no longer be leaking into space. For us, then, L will probably turn out to be about 100 years. So depending on what you choose for L, a value we can barely model after our own human civilization, you can get anything from N equals 1 to N equals millions. Regard this as another way to express our ignorance of our place in the universe.
A tweet. Note to Hollywood. No reason to think space aliens would have the same array of senses, sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell, as humans. They could have more senses than we do, or all their senses could be completely different from ours.
Is technology inevitable? The story of life on Earth describes increasing complexity, from microbes to multi-celled organisms to the development of technology. But is this development inevitable? Must life, in other words, always lead to intelligence? And must intelligence always lead to technology? One thing we have learned in our search for exoplanets is that there is a myriad of worlds out there so diverse that any world you could imagine probably exists somewhere. Molten lava ocean worlds? Probably. A planet made of solid diamond? Why not? A pond scum planet that would eventually house a spacefaring species? Well, for billions of years, single-celled organisms inhabited a pond scum planet called Earth. The onset of multi-celled life about 550 million years ago correlates with striking environmental changes. Glaciers retreated, and oxygen levels in the atmosphere rose. On a planet without those extraordinary upheavals, the green pond scum might have continued unabated to this day, never leading to intelligent life. It's easy to see how traits associated with intelligence, knowing where to find food and how to avoid predators, for example, would confer an evolutionary advantage once complex life forms appeared. But do they necessarily lead to technology? Again, the history of life on our own planet can point us toward an answer. For more than 200 million years, dinosaurs dominated Earth. In their world, the top evolutionary advantages were conferred by traits like size and speed. Tyrannosaurus Rex didn't need tools to do well in its environment, so tools never appeared. Not until about 2 million years ago did our ancestor, Homo habilis, start down the road to technology by shaping rocks into crude tools. Had the dinosaurs not been driven to extinction by the impact of an asteroid, then mammals, including human beings, might never have become the dominant life forms. In this case, Earth might have remained a dinosaur planet, a planet with life, perhaps even intelligent life, depending on one's definition, but no technology.
The Wow Signal. On August 15, 1977, Ohio State University's radio telescope called Big Ear detected a signal whose origin remains clouded in mystery. It was a strong signal, lasting for a full 72 seconds before Earth's rotation carried the telescope to a position where the source of the signal was no longer visible to it. Astrophysicist Jerry Amon found the record of the reception when going through a printout of the data a few days later. It was so singular and so much in line with what we'd expect from an extraterrestrial signal that he wrote "Wow" on the paper in red ink, forever giving the signal its name. Well, it's been more than 40 years since WOW, and despite repeated searches, it has never been seen again. Bigger radio telescopes operating in 1977 didn't see the signal at all, nor did some of the detectors on the Big Ear itself. Possible explanations have been proposed. It was an Earth signal reflected off orbiting space junk, or it was radiation from a newly discovered comet. But none of these explanations has achieved widespread acceptance. Space aliens, anyone? Perhaps it's best to take the advice of Jerry Amon, who, 20 years after his discovery, warned us not to draw vast conclusions from half-vast data.
SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. The most romanticized endeavor of any space program in popular culture, overwhelmingly depicted on the big screen and in novels, is the quest to discover an advanced technological civilization with which we could converse. Looking for such a civilization is the goal of a program called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. SETI began in 1959 with an article in the prestigious British science journal Nature, remarking that our emerging ability to build radio telescopes meant that if anyone out there was sending signals, we would be able to detect them. If the phone was ringing, in other words, we could now pick it up. This paper led to the conference where the Drake equation was first written down, and the long, though sporadic, search for those signals began. The problems SETI researchers face can be summarized by asking two questions. Where do you look? And what do you look for? The where question is fairly easy to answer. We should start searching for signals from planets circling sun-like stars in our immediate neighborhood. A search for what we've called life like us. The what question is more difficult, because there are a huge number of frequencies that an alien civilization might choose to employ. The original Nature paper, for example, suggested that signals would be sent at a microwave frequency corresponding to a particular phenomenon that takes place in hydrogen molecules, because this was the most common radiation generated by the most common element in the universe. Over the years, other special frequencies have been proposed, but all of them have involved somewhat arcane arguments about how extraterrestrials might view the universe. In the end, the main SETI program settled down to carrying on a daunting all-sky search for radio frequencies. The insatiable need for computing power to perform this task prompted astrophysicists at the University of California at Berkeley to start a program in the late 1990s called SETI at Home, a project that allows people to become citizen scientists and use their personal computers to analyze SETI data. The Berkeley team sends data packets that can be analyzed by personal computers when they are otherwise idle. You can still walk into offices around the world and see idle computers crunching through SETI data. Despite the millions of deputized computers, and despite the number of engaged telescopes over the years, no evidence for the existence of an advanced technological civilization in the Milky Way galaxy has emerged. But the search must continue. SETI is one of the few experiments in science whose results would be significant no matter which way it turns out. Jill Tarter, Chair Emeritus at the SETI Institute, put it this way on a Star Talk episode. Take the volume of space and frequencies and time that we might have to search to find extraterrestrial intelligence, and set that volume equal to the volume of Earth's oceans. How much have we sampled in the last 50 years? 1 12-ounce glass. So, if you scoop out one glass from an ocean and don't see any fish, can you claim that there are no fish in the ocean? You would be inexcusably short-sighted to do so.
A tweet. Imagine a world where nations find the search for life in the universe more interesting than the taking of life on Earth.
Continuously habitable zone. If Earth were somewhat closer to the sun, we could have wound up like Venus, a scorching, waterless desert. If Earth were a bit farther away, we might now be frozen solid. That delineates an orbital band around our sun within which our planet has evolved to support life. We can use that concept to describe the neighborhood around any star where oceans of liquid water could have survived in an orbiting planet's surface for billions of years, the time required to develop complex life. This region is called the continuously habitable zone, CHZ, of a star, where conditions are not too hot, not too cold, but just right to support life. Earning the nickname Goldilocks Zone. Every star has a CHZ. It hugs a smaller star more closely than a larger one. And of course, all sorts of bells and whistles go into the actual characterization of a CHZ. The composition of a planet's atmosphere, for example, and the planet's gravity, which governs whether or not molecules escape into space. No matter how you concoct the perfect Goldilocks zone, though, this concept leads us to seek out not just any kind of life, but life as we know it. The implicit and explicit thought behind the CHZ is that life requires surface oceans to arise. We have this built-in bias, of course, because that's exactly where life developed on Earth. But planetary surfaces are not the only place we find oceans. The smallish moon of Jupiter, called Europa, has more water beneath its icy surface than is found in all five oceans on Earth. Thus, if we really want to follow the water in our quest for life elsewhere, those subsurface oceans within our own solar system, oceans that lie well outside the sun's CHZ, should be on the list, too. Nevertheless, the search for life and advanced civilizations elsewhere in the universe has focused on Earth-sized exoplanets that lie within their stars' Goldilocks zones. For a while, headlines blared that a possible abode of life had been found every time this sort of planet was discovered. The world's newspapers went positively ballistic in 2016 when astronomers announced the presence of seven Earth-sized planets orbiting the star TRAPPIST-1, with three nested cozily in the CHZ. There is no doubt that the CHZ is a good place to look for life like us, that is, life based on molecules containing carbon interacting in liquid water. The danger is, if we perpetuate our favoritisms in our search for life, we may blind ourselves from discovering other kinds of life. The Fermi Paradox. In 1950, physicist Enrico Fermi and a group of colleagues were walking to lunch at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. They were chatting about a spate of UFO sightings in the neighborhood, and the conversation naturally turned to the question of whether there really were extraterrestrial civilizations out there. Later, over lunch, Fermi asked a simple question for which we still don't have an answer. Where is everybody? To see the importance of this question, you have to understand a little about Fermi and a little about how people viewed the universe in 1950. Fermi, a Nobel laureate, was the man who had been in charge of building the world's first nuclear reactor. He was also well known for devising quick ways of estimating the answers to seemingly intractable questions, such as, how many extraterrestrial civilizations are out there? Although we cannot know for sure, we can make a pretty good guess at what was going through Fermi's mind before he asked his question. A full decade before Drake proposed his famous equation, Fermi had probably made a quick estimate of the number of planets in the Milky Way capable of evolving advanced life. He also would have made a quick estimate of how long it would take an advanced civilization to colonize the entire galaxy. At that point, he'd realized that, one, there could be lots of extraterrestrial civilizations out there, and, two, a spacefaring race would take only a few 100,000 years, a blink of an eye in astronomical time, to colonize the entire galaxy. The results of these calculations raise immediate questions. If the galaxy is really full of advanced civilizations, where are they? Why haven't they contacted us? And if the colonization time is really that short, why haven't the extraterrestrials shown up on our doorstep? The simplest answer is that they aren't there. They aren't anywhere. This conundrum has become known as the Fermi Paradox. Over the years, a number of intriguing responses to Fermi's question and its corollaries have been proposed. Here we offer the top three. The Zoo Hypothesis. They're really out there, but for some reason they've decided not to interfere in our development. An example of this hypothesis is the Prime Directive in the Star Trek series, which forbids contact with primitive societies, lest such contact disrupt their biological or cultural evolution. In this scheme, Earth is seen as something like a zoo or a nature preserve. The Rare Earth Hypothesis. The sequence of events that led to the evolution of intelligent life on Earth is so contingent, so unlikely to repeat, that Earth hosts the only advanced civilization in the galaxy. In this scheme, extraterrestrials aren't there because they never evolved. This scenario is popular with religions that favor Earth as God's unique and special place in the universe. The Doomsday Scenario. To win the evolutionary struggle, life forms must use aggression. But when an aggressive organism acquires modern science and technology, this is precisely the power with which that organism can wipe itself out. In this scheme, extraterrestrials destroyed themselves before they start communicating or colonizing. So, where is everybody? Again, we just don't know.
A tweet. From the Dad Joke Vault. Question. What do you call embryonic space aliens? Answer. Extraterrestrials. The Dyson Sphere. Nearly all life on Earth depends on energy from the sun. But Earth receives only a tiny fraction of the light the star emits. Most of the energy the sun emits goes off into space, which is true for any star in the sky. After all, the only reason we can see stars is that their light has escaped from the region around them. From the point of view of an advanced civilization, then, most of the energy a star generates is wasted. In 1960, American physicist Freeman Dyson argued that a truly advanced technological civilization would tap into this energy source by building large solar collectors that catch the light before it leaves the region around the star. Fully realized, these collectors completely enclose the star, collecting all of its emitted energy. This structure, which has come to be called a Dyson sphere, would require a truly advanced technology to build. Just ask yourself, where you'd get the material to build such a massive structure? It may require that you mine all the natural resources of all planets for the project.
Ranking Civilizations. In 1963, the Russian astrophysicist Nikolai Kardashev, not to be confused with the more famous Kardashians, was part of the team that conducted the first SETI in the Soviet Union. As part of his work, he classified civilizations far more advanced than we are, the kind of civilization everyone expects to encounter out there, into what became known as the Kardashev Scale. In its current incarnation, the Kardashev scale ranks civilizations based on their ability to generate and use energy, and puts them into three categories. Type 1. Can generate or control all of the energy available within its planet. Type 2. Can generate or control all of the energy generated by its host star. Type 3. Can generate or control all of the energy generated by all the stars in its galaxy. In this scheme, the human race hasn't even gotten to type 1. Extrapolation schemes put us above 0, but nowhere near 1 on the Kardashev scale today. There has been progress, though. Some calculations suggest, for example, that when Homo habilis started using stone tools a couple of million years ago, we were at 0.1. So we have definitely been moving up. Some informed futurists think that we may be only a few hundred years from achieving full Type 1 status. This would surely include energy generation via nuclear fusion, which we don't yet have. A Type 2 civilization would certainly have spaceflight and may have built a Dyson sphere, which traps all the energy emitted by the host star and feeds it back to the planet, serving the energy-hungry needs of that Type 2 civilization. This would take place at best thousands of years into the human future. A Type 3 civilization is difficult to even imagine. A galaxy composed entirely of Dyson spheres around its stars might qualify, as would a galaxy completely enclosed within a Dyson sphere. Makes you wonder, If type 2 or 3 civilizations exist, would their hypothesized Dyson spheres block any signals we might otherwise receive?
Keeping up with the Kardashev scale. 1 terawatt hour. Equal to 1 billion kilowatt hours. Estimated energy production of Earth in 1890. 18 terawatt hours. Estimated total energy production of Earth today. 108 terawatt hours. Estimated total energy production of Earth needed to move up to type 1 on the Kardashev scale. In other words, we need to sextuple our energy production in order to move up to type 1 on the Kardashev scale.
Chapter 8. How did it all begin? The way things are. Quantum Mechanics 101. Simplification and unification. Quark confinement. The unification of forces. The unification of the strong force. The antimatter problem. The grand scenario. The end of knowledge. 8. The most interesting events in the history of the universe happened during the first thousandth of a second. To go that far back in time and understand the origins of the universe, we need to bring together two seemingly disparate branches of science, cosmology and elementary particle physics. That's a curious tryst between the study of the universe, the biggest thing we know, and the study of subatomic particles, the smallest things we know. Our cosmos has been expanding and cooling for almost 14 billion years. Early in its life, the universe was smaller and hotter, and its constituents collided with one another much more violently than they do in our own relatively frigid era. Complex structures like molecules, atoms, and even elementary particles could not stand the stress of these collisions. Only their smaller, simpler components could. The early history of the universe is the evolution of these components. We've already talked about one of these evolutionary milestones. About 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe cooled enough for atoms to survive the collisions. Until this time, ordinary matter had existed as plasma, with unfettered, negatively charged electrons and positively charged nuclei wandering free, absorbing and re-emitting electromagnetic radiation. The formation of whole atoms neutralized the plasma, cleared the decks, and freed the radiation, which eventually became the cosmic microwave background. At the same time, ordinary matter fell into the gravitational wells shaped by dark matter. The emergence of galaxies, stars, and human intelligence all followed from this event. Rewind the video farther to witness a similar transition just 3 minutes after the Big Bang, when the universe had cooled enough for the nuclei of atoms to survive. Before this time, ordinary matter existed in the form of distinct protons and electrons, but no more complex structures could survive. Even here, when the universe was a mere 3 minutes old, matter took a familiar form, comprising the same particles we see around us today, and the forces that prevailed in this early chapter of the universe were the same as those we see in action today. For departures from this familiarity, we must go much farther back in time, to when the universe was less than a thousandth of a second old. The way things are. If we're going to talk about how the universe evolved to its present state, we should have a clear idea of what that state is. Ordinary matter in the universe was built from a few elementary particles. Now, think of them as the bricks from which a universe is constructed. Some of these bricks are made of baryons, particles normally found in the nuclei of atoms, like protons and neutrons, each made from quarks. As previously discussed, we know of 6 types of quarks that pair up into what are called flavors: up and down, charm and strange, and bottom and top. But there is another class of cosmic bricks called leptons, of which we also know 6 kinds. The most familiar is the electron, but there are 2 more, called the mu and the tau, which are like the electron but heavier. And for each of these particles, there's a corresponding neutrino, carrying zero electric charge and hardly any mass. Although these exotic leptons may seem strange, all six of them are produced and studied copiously in modern particle accelerators, the huge machines that allow us to generate subatomic phenomena thought to replicate those at the beginning of time. So the bricks from which all ordinary matter is built amount to six quarks and six leptons. You read that correctly. Just 12 particles construct the known universe. How do these particles interact with one another? What forces bind them together or tear them apart? In fact, four forces operate today, the mortar to our bricks of the universe. Two are familiar in everyday life, gravity and electromagnetism. Two others operate within the nucleus of atoms and are less familiar, the strong and weak forces. Because they aren't as common, let's take a moment to introduce them. We'll start with the strong force. Protons in the nucleus of an atom all have the same charge, so they want to fly apart due to electromagnetic repulsion. We learned this in middle school. Like charges repel. But somehow all the protons are content as a clam huddled together in one place. To overcome the repulsion, there must be a countervailing force holding the nucleus together. Enter the strong force, which became a central object of study in 20th century physics. Still, despite the strong force holding them all together, many nuclei and elementary particles undergo radioactive decay, a term coined by none other than two-time Nobel Prize-winning Polish chemist Marie Curie. Radioactive decay happens when the weak force triggers the nucleus of an atom to lose energy by way of radiation. So there you have it. Six quarks, six leptons, and four forces manifest after the universe's first thousandth of a second. But what happened before then? What pre-endowed the cosmos to give us this particular universe?
A tweet. Scientists are simply adults who retained and nurtured their native curiosity from childhood. 6 + 6 = Why are there six quarks and six leptons? Good question. We wish we knew the answer.
Quantum Mechanics 101. To continue our journey backward in time, we need to enter the atom itself. A strange place, described by one of the great theories of physics called quantum mechanics. Quantum is the Latin word for heap or bundle. And mechanics is the old name for the science of motion. Thus, quantum mechanics is the study of the motion of things that come in bundles, as they do inside the atom. It's an entirely different world from the Newtonian mechanics of everyday life, so let's take a brief side trip into this quantum world. For our purposes, we will talk about only one aspect of quantum mechanics. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle, named after German physicist Werner Heisenberg. A version of the principle relevant to our discussion says that the more precisely you know how much energy a system has, the less precisely you know when in time it possesses that energy. Remember the children's fairy tale Cinderella? She could dress up and go to the ball, transformed, and no one would be the wiser as long as she got home by midnight. In the same way, in the quantum world, an extra particle can pop into existence so long as it disappears fast enough, where fast enough is defined by the uncertainty principle. Particles that appear and disappear in this way are considered virtual. A proton sitting by itself can, for a short time, become both a proton and another particle, like Cinderella at the ball. The mass of the extra particle, after all, is just another form of energy. Remember, E equals mc squared. So the extra particle can hide behind Heisenberg's energy uncertainty. So long as that extra particle disappears in a short enough time, the uncertainty principle tells us we will never be able to tell the difference between a system with that particle and one without it. In the 1930s, Japanese physicist Hideki Yukawa realized the particle that emits a virtual particle need not be the same one that absorbs it. He found that when two ordinary particles exchanged a virtual particle, there was a force acting between them. Think of it like two ice skaters. When pushed on slippery ice, they easily surrender to the force acting on them and slide in the direction of the push. If one ice skater throws a heavy ball at the other, the release of mass will cause the skater throwing the ball to recoil, while the one catching the ball will slide backward from its momentum. In other words, an exchange of undetectable virtual particles in the quantum world generates forces. Furthermore, the type of virtual particle exchanged defines the force. In fact, the exchanged virtual particle can be identified for three of the four forces. The strong force comes from the exchange of particles called gluons, sensibly named because they enable elementary particles to stick together. The electromagnetic force comes from the photon, while the weak force comes from particles called vector bosons. That's three of the four forces: strong, electromagnetic, and weak. At the moment, gravity cannot be described this way, a fact that, as we shall see, remains one of the greatest frontiers in theoretical physics.
A tweet. You matter. Unless you multiply yourself by the speed of light squared, then you energy. Quantum mechanics is hard. Known for his pioneering work in quantum mechanics, the American theoretical physicist and Nobel laureate Richard Feynman once admitted, "I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. So if these concepts feel especially tricky, you're in good company." But the very pursuit of understanding them grants insight to how our universe came to be. And who could argue with the Austrian-American physicist Victor Weisskopf, who once remarked, "There are only two things that make life worth living: Mozart and quantum mechanics."
Simplification and unification. When the universe was young, it was hot and simple. And when the universe was younger than that, it was hotter and simpler still. The highly ordered structure of the atoms that formed much later when the universe was 380,000 years old was much more complex than the random plasma sea of charged particles from which it evolved. In the same way, the nuclei that formed when the universe was 3 minutes old were more complex than the jumble of elementary particles that preceded them. Like dismantling a building into its structural supports and constituent bricks, we can trace the history of the universe back toward its foundations. But another simplification in the quantum world is possible, for which there is no analog in everyday experience. It involves the four fundamental forces, what we have called the mortar between the bricks of the universe: strong, electromagnetic, weak, and gravity. Let's start by asking a strange question. How many forces do you need to build a universe? In a universe with no forces, nothing would happen, and that's clearly not the universe we live in. We need at least one force to build a universe, but we really don't need more. In the simplest possible universe, then, there will be only one force. If going backward in time really corresponds with moving toward greater simplicity, there will have to be transitions that reduce the number of acting forces ultimately down to one. We refer to this yet-to-be-achieved idea as the unification of forces, called the unified field theory in Einstein's day. In the quantum world, forces exist because virtual particles pass between actual particles. We used the analogy of two ice skaters exchanging a heavy ball to generate a force. Let's extend that analogy and imagine two pairs of ice skaters gliding toward each other. Perhaps they're in an outdoor ice rink on a cold winter's day. A skater from one pair wields a bucket of water mixed with antifreeze, while a skater from the other pair wields a bucket filled with water that is frozen. If the skaters now move toward each other and hurl the contents of their assigned buckets toward their partner, we'll see one skater splashed with liquid and the other catching a hunk of solid ice. We would, in other words, see two different phenomena operating in the ice rink. If we repeated the experiment in the summer, however, the bucket of ice would have melted, and we'd see only one kind of phenomenon, an exchange of liquid. We would realize we saw two different phenomena the first time only because the temperature was low. Higher temperatures were required to reveal the two phenomena as the same. By analogy, as we move backward in time through the first thousandth of a second, the increase in temperature unifies the forces. They begin to behave in the same way as one another. In fact, the farther back in time we go, the fewer distinct forces there were in the universe. And with this, we are ready to begin our journey into the heart of creation.
A tweet. In 5 billion years, our Milky Way begins to collide with the Andromeda Galaxy. But not to worry. The sun burns Earth to a crisp long before then.
Quark confinement. The next significant event that we encounter as we move backward in time happens at 10 microseconds, or 10 to the negative 5 seconds, after the Big Bang. At this moment, free-roaming quarks find companion quarks and settle down into particles, including some we know and love. There were two families of them. Three quark combos formed particles like protons and neutrons, while quark-antiquark pairs formed mesons. At first glance, this event looks like the formation of nuclei and atoms that occurred much later. There is, however, a crucial difference. The force between quarks is generated by an exchange of gluons, and this force is different from the familiar electromagnetic and gravitational forces in one important respect. As noted earlier, the force between quarks gets stronger, not weaker, the farther apart they are. The farther apart you stretch a rubber band, the harder you have to pull to stretch it more. In the same way, the farther apart two quarks are, the harder you have to pull, the more energy you must invest to separate them. Now imagine that you have a proton and you reach inside and grab one of its three quarks. Your goal is to pull out the quark. At first, it's easy going. The force holding the quark is small and easily overcome. As you pull your quark farther away, though, the effort becomes harder and harder. Eventually, you've pumped so much energy into the system that you've created two more quarks in the form of a meson. At that point, it was easier for nature to convert that energy to quark mass, invoking E equals mc squared, than to increase the separation farther. The lesson? No matter how hard you hit a particle, you will never produce a free quark.
Writing small numbers. As we go back in time toward the Big Bang, we talk about shorter and shorter time periods, using numbers that are expressed in what is called powers of 10 notation. A number written as 10 to the minus 3 can also be written as a 1 with the decimal point shifted 3 places to the left. Thus, a thousandth of a second would be written as 10 to the minus 3 seconds, or 0.001 second. A microsecond, a millionth of a second, would be written 10 to the minus 6, or 0.000001 second, and so on.
The unification of forces. So far, we've moved back through three checkpoints in time. 380,000 years, 3 minutes, and 10 to the negative 5 seconds after the Big Bang. Each moment marks a change in the nature of matter. Complex structures like atoms, starting at 380,000 years, ultimately arose from a sea of quarks and leptons, existing before 10 to the negative 5 seconds after the Big Bang. For all this time, however, there has been no change in the fundamental forces involved. Only the bricks of our universe have changed. Our mortar has remained. Even with matter broken down into its fundamental constituents, it still interacts through the same four forces we experience today. But all that's about to change. As we continue turning back the clock, the next fundamental change we encounter occurs at 10 to the negative 10 seconds, a tenth of a nanosecond, after the Big Bang. It's right around then that forces begin to unify. Before 10 to the negative 10 seconds, there were only three forces acting. The strong force, gravity, and a unified force we can call the electroweak. Only after this time did the electromagnetic and weak forces separate with two distinct identities. Amazingly enough, a machine like the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland can reproduce conditions of the early universe when it was 10 to the negative 10 seconds old. For a brief moment, those conditions exist in a volume the size of a proton deep inside the machine. Unfortunately, at the moment, we don't yet know how to build machines with enough oomph to replicate conditions any closer to the Big Bang itself. And so, the unification of the electromagnetic and weak forces, 10 to the negative 10 seconds after the Big Bang, marks the point beyond which we cannot test our ideas through experiments.
Albert Einstein's failed quest. Albert Einstein spent much of his later years trying, unsuccessfully, to produce a unified field theory. But how did a physicist of his caliber fail at this task? It turns out that Einstein was trying to unify the wrong forces. He concentrated on how gravity and electromagnetism might marry, a question we have yet to answer. In Einstein's defense, at the time, the weak and strong forces had only recently been discovered and were yet to be deeply understood.
The unification of the strong force. Resuming our journey backward, we must cross a huge interval of time before we find another crucial change, all the way back to 10 to the negative 35 seconds after the Big Bang. This number represents a period of time so tiny that there is nothing in our human experience with which to compare it. Nevertheless, our best theories tell us that this was when the basic bricks of our universe were formed, the time when the six quarks and six leptons first showed up. Of course, whatever our ideas tell us about the behavior of the universe in this early epoch, we have no way to check those hypotheses experimentally. We do, however, have a theory called the Standard Model of Particle Physics, which nicely explains the behavior of matter at energies accessible to modern accelerators, and then some. But even optimistic physicists will not push the theory earlier than 10 to the negative 35 seconds after the Big Bang. So for now, we think of this time as the limit of any understanding that carries confidence. That moment, 10 to the negative 35 seconds after the Big Bang, represents a turning point. Before then, only two forces acted in the universe, gravity and the strong force unified with the electroweak. Thus, events at this time can be thought of as another example of simplification, a moment after which many more complex features emerged that would become fixtures in the modern universe. Theoretical physicists are nothing if not inventive, however, and the fact that we have no good ideas that take us farther back in time doesn't mean we have no ideas at all. In fact, many have been proposed. We'll look at some of the more interesting hypotheses in the next chapter. But note that most of the community of physicists expects the next and final unification of forces to occur at 10 to the negative 43 seconds. We call this the Planck time, to honor the German physicist Max Planck, who is generally recognized as the founder of quantum mechanics. For all times earlier, we expect that gravity and the strong electroweak force were unified as one. The large-scale universe, nicely explained by general relativity's description of gravity, the theory of the large, now occupies tiny volumes controlled by quantum mechanics, the theory of the small. To understand this shotgun marriage, we desperately need a quantum theory of gravity. Before we take that final step, however, let's raise one troubling fact: that matter exists in our universe at all.
A tweet. Everything we know and understand about the universe is driven by just three forces: strong nuclear, electroweak, and gravity.
The antimatter problem. Why does matter exist at all? Our entire understanding of mass and energy in the universe tells us, guided by E equals mc squared, that when high-energy light, X-rays and gamma rays, becomes mass, it spontaneously creates pairs of matter and antimatter particles. Thereafter, when either particle finds its matched antiparticle, they annihilate, becoming pure energy once again. When the early universe was hot enough for X-rays and gamma rays to dominate the energy spectrum, this two-way street, energy becoming matter, becoming energy, becoming matter, unfurled continually. But as the universe expanded, it cooled to energies that could no longer spontaneously create matter-antimatter particle pairs. There are no known particles with mass that low. That's odd when you think about it. If all mass created in the universe comes from matter-antimatter pairs spawned from X-rays and gamma rays, then what actually happens when the universe cooled so much that there were no X-rays or gamma rays left? Under that scenario, every particle ever created has an antimatter counterpart. As the universe continues to cool, particles eventually meet up with their antiparticles and annihilate for one last time, leaving a universe of light and nothing else. So, modern physics tells us the universe should have no matter of any kind in it at all. But we do. In fact, we're all made of matter and not antimatter. So, somehow, at some point in the early universe, a few X-rays or gamma rays spontaneously made just one lone matter particle, causing a profound asymmetry to the balance of particles in the universe. To account for what we see, calculations require that about 1 in 100 million of these conversions creates a lone matter particle, violating key conservation laws of particle physics. Perhaps this was another one of those mysterious but real changes in the early universe. That's the explanation we're going with, and we're sticking to it. For now. The grand scenario. We can finally piece together the entire history of the universe as we understand it, down to when our theories start to break down. Let's replay the story now. 10^-43 seconds after. Everything we describe up to this moment, the Planck time, is speculation. We have no experimental data or solid theories to guide us. Nevertheless, we expect that only one force existed in the universe. Some of our theories also predict that there was only one kind of particle as well. If this is true, then the universe started out in the simplest state imaginable, a universe composed of one kind of particle interacting through one kind of force. 10^-35 seconds after. Here, the universe undergoes a slew of changes. For one thing, it rapidly expands during a time called inflation. Slightly more matter than antimatter is produced. Specifically, 100 million and 1 matter particles for every 100 million antimatter particles. The antimatter-matter particle pairs find each other and annihilate to produce intense radiation, which eventually becomes the cosmic microwave background. The strong force splits away, leaving the universe with 3 operating forces instead of 2, gravity, strong, and electroweak. 10^-10 seconds after. Here, the electromagnetic force splits away from the weak force, marking the final splitting of the forces from 3 into the 4 we see today, strong, weak, gravity, and electromagnetic. 10^-5 seconds after. This time marks the arrival of familiar particles and atomic structures. Quarks assemble to form the elementary particles found within the nucleus, such as protons and neutrons. Once inside the elementary particles, the quarks are confined and no longer exist on their own. 3 minutes after. Here, the temperature has dropped enough to enable a proton and neutron to combine and form a simple nucleus without subsequent collisions knocking them apart. For a brief period, nuclei of atoms up to lithium in complexity are formed. The Hubble expansion then spreads particles too far apart for them to continue building nuclei. After 3 minutes, matter and radiation coexist in the form of a plasma. And any attempt for matter to clump is swiftly blown apart by the high-energy radiation. Dark matter, on the other hand, gathers under the influence of gravity, invisible and impervious to the destructive powers of radiation. 380,000 years after. Atoms form as electrons attach to nuclei, freeing the light and rendering the universe transparent. This radiation manifests today as the cosmic microwave background, and ordinary matter clumps to form stars and galaxies wherever dark matter is found. In short, everything began in the simplest possible state and from there expanded and evolved into the complex universe we know today. The end of knowledge. Well, that's it. We've come as far in understanding the origins of the universe as we can. Beyond this point in our journey, only hypotheses and conjectures remain, nothing more. And as any curious person knows, the most interesting questions are the ones we don't yet know to ask. Standing on our milepost of 10 to the negative 35 seconds and looking backward in time, we can see two mountains we'll have to climb. The first is what does or doesn't happen at and before 10 to the negative 43 seconds, the Planck time. As previously noted, the consensus among theoretical physicists is that the trend line of unified forces will continue, and that at the Planck time, the gravitational force will unify with the strong electroweak. We know that at the quantum level, the exchange of virtual particles generates the strong electromagnetic and weak forces. According to general relativity, however, gravity results from the warping of space-time by the presence of matter, a force at work with nary a mention of virtual particle exchanges. Thus, creating a theory of gravity that works in the quantum world isn't just a matter of fiddling around with equations. It involves reconciling two fundamentally different ideas of how forces can be generated. But even if we solve this problem, we are left with a higher mountain to climb, the nature of the initial event itself. If we think time began at the Big Bang, then the question, what preceded the Big Bang, doesn't make sense. Additionally, according to some ideas, the exact nature of the universe isn't locked into one set of physical laws, but can vary. In this situation, we can have many coexisting universes, a multiverse. These are universes that exist side by side, each governed by its own slate of cosmic laws, with no two of them ever meeting. Fasten your seatbelts, then, for a journey into unknown unknowns.
A tweet. Ever look up at night and feel small? Don't. Instead, feel large. Atoms in our bodies trace to the remnants of exploded stars. We are stardust. We are alive in the universe, and the universe is alive within us.
Chapter 9. How will it all end? The end of Earth. Unpredictable doomsday, volcanoes. Unpredictable doomsday, impact. The coming collision. Open, closed, or flat. What is the matter? Options for the end. The edge of the map of time. Watching the end of the universe. 9. When we think about the end of the universe, we naturally first wonder about our own solar neighborhood and the end of the sun. Like all stars, our sun deploys one tactic after another to hold itself up against the force of gravity. Each new strategy shapes an episode in the saga of its death. As previously explained, the solar system began as a collapsing interstellar cloud, governed by the inexorable inward pull of gravity. When the resulting compression raised the core temperature high enough, nuclear reactions ignited, fusing hydrogen into helium. Specifically, four protons combined and transformed to become a single helium nucleus containing two protons and two neutrons, plus a spray of other particles, plus energy. The resulting outpouring of radiation balanced the inward pull of gravity, and the sun became stable. The sun has been fusing hydrogen in its core for about 4.5 billion years. In about 5 billion more years, it will have consumed all the hydrogen in its core. And the force of gravity, kept in check for almost 10 billion years, will reassert itself, threatening collapse. There are, in fact, two sources of energy available to counteract this collapse, One is the pristine, unfused hydrogen in a shell around the core. The other is a series of nuclear reactions that convert the helium ash to carbon in the core. For that, the proton inventory checks out. Three helium nuclei, each with two protons, fuse to become one carbon nucleus containing six protons. The sun employs both these tactics as it enters old age, resulting in a complex series of events. The most important of these are, one, the sun will lose about a third of its mass from a vastly increased solar wind, and two, the outer envelope of the sun will expand and cool as it transforms into a new category of star, called a red giant, sequentially engulfing the orbits of Mercury and Venus, and threatening to do the same of Earth. Eventually, all this expanding gas escapes into interstellar space, laying bare a tiny, stable, hot stellar corpse. Best to be somewhere else when all this unfolds. A star like the sun isn't massive enough to ignite more nuclear reactions beyond converting helium to carbon, so there is nothing to prevent the inevitable collapse. At this point, however, a new character enters our saga. Electrons that were torn from their atoms early on and have been in the plasma background for billions of years now step up. The laws of quantum mechanics tell us that a cloud of electrons cannot be compressed indefinitely. You can say that each electron requires some elbow room to maintain its identity. The force of gravity can compress what remains of the sun to about the size of Earth before running into the outward pressure of these electrons, and the compression stops forever. The sun terminally becomes a star, called a white dwarf, an ember slowly cooling in the sky. And the saga of its life ends here.
How old are we? If the lifetime of the universe were compressed into a single year, the sun and the solar system were born in early September, fairly late in the lifetime of the Milky Way.
The end of Earth. So, while the sun battles for life against its own collapse, what's happening on our homeworld? The most striking change comes from a rise in the sun's luminosity. Although the sun has been generating energy by fusing hydrogen in its core for 4.5 billion years, and will continue to do so for another 5 billion, it grows brighter all the while. When the planets formed, for example, the sun was about 30% fainter than it is today, and has steadily brightened, becoming about two-thirds again more luminous by the time the hydrogen in its core is used up. So how will the planet respond to this kind of warming? To be clear, life as we know it would not survive this new threat, at least not on Earth. And no, the warming we are experiencing today cannot be explained by the sun's stately life cycle. Ignoring whatever humans might do to Earth over the next few million years, our planet won't look much different than it does today. Ice ages, which depend primarily on the details of Earth's rotation and orbit around the sun, will continue to come and go. They will, however, become less frequent as the sun warms the planet. The slow, steady motion of the continents, driven by convection in Earth's mantle, will be unaffected in the short term. Geophysicists have suggested, in fact, that in another 250 million years, all the continents will be reunited into one supercontinent, a reprise of what existed 250 million years ago in the form of Pangaea. A billion years from now, the planet's average temperature will have risen above our own body temperature. At those levels, evaporation rates increase, and more moisture enters the atmosphere from our oceans, seas, and lakes. Ultraviolet radiation from the sun will then break apart those H2O water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen atoms. The lighter, faster-moving hydrogen atoms will escape to space as the oceans disappear entirely, desiccating the entire planet. Volcanoes will continue to erupt, spewing deep stores of water and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But without the oceans to help uptake atmospheric carbon dioxide, as they do continuously today, a strong greenhouse effect will ensue. With ultraviolet light from the sun continuously killing the H2O molecules, the subcrystal lubrication provided by water will cease, forcing plate tectonics to grind to a halt as the continents lock into place, Eventually, about 3 to 4 billion years in the future, the runaway greenhouse effect will raise the surface temperature of the planet high enough to liquefy our rocky surface into a lava ocean. The final act will come when the sun enters its red giant phase and its outer regions swell to extend beyond Earth's orbit. Because at that point the sun will have lost mass from increased solar wind, its gravitational grip on the planets will be reduced, sending Earth into a steadily larger orbit. If the sun does not actually swallow it up altogether, Earth will be fated to circle the white dwarf as a dead, charred cinder. This might be a good time to ask, how's that space program coming along?
A tweet. In 5 billion years, as the sun begins to die, its outer layers of glowing plasma will expand stupendously, engulfing the orbits of Mercury, then Venus, as the charred ember that was once the oasis of life, called Earth, vaporizes into the vacuum of space. Have a nice day. Pangaea. Some 250 million years ago, all the land on Earth was connected into a supercontinent called Pangaea, ancient Greek for all Earth. Then magma welled up from beneath the crust, creating rifts and diverting landmasses into the 7 continents we see today. Evidence of identical sedimentary layers and fossil species on the coastlines of faraway continents affirm this phenomenon. In another 250 million years, geologists predict the continents will reform into a single supercontinent, resulting in a hypothetical landmass dubbed Pangaea Proxima, the next Pangaea.
Unpredictable doomsday, volcanoes. The sun's evolution isn't the only threat to the welfare of life as we know it. Earth abounds with perils lying in wait, like volcanoes. We live on a planet that was once entirely molten and is still cooling off. Liquefied rock, called magma, transports heat to the planet's surface, producing all sorts of phenomena, from hot springs to volcanic eruptions. Most of the time, these eruptions, no matter how spectacular, affect only a relatively small